God of all, may the words of my mouth and the meditations of all our hearts be pleasing to you this morning and always. You are our rock and our redeemer, O Lord. Amen. So last fall, I was asked if I would be one of the preachers during this in-between time between the departure of our interim pastor and the arrival of our new pastor. I thought it would be a good opportunity to share a little about what we on the search committee have learned about our church, its challenges, and its strengths. We learned that our church has a strong reputation and a proud history, that we are well respected around the Baptist world, so much, in fact, that a number of very talented ministers wanted to talk to us about being our next pastor. Well, we also learned that people all over had been paying attention to our recent challenges and were curious about how we were doing. Every time I met with somebody for the first time about our pastor search process, someone would bring up this or that story that they had heard about First Baptist and inevitably ask, "So how are y'all doing over there?" I'm pleased to say that I think we are doing pretty well, but perhaps we should talk about that a little bit. A few weeks ago, right after our recent call weekend, that wonderful combined service that we had in here, followed by a unanimous vote to call David Jordan to lead us, the very next week, Peter Ray Jones stood right in this spot and practically called the pastor search committee smug. Did you hear that? I did. Now, I will admit that that weekend felt pretty good. I can't speak for the rest of our committee, but I felt a real sense of accomplishment and even pride hearing so many people speak approvingly and even excitedly about the leader we had found. Yes, I admit, I felt a little like the mayor of First Baptist that weekend. Everybody slapping me on the back and saying nice things. But come on, I know how this works. Let's be honest. One day, 6 months or 3 years from now, David Jordan will say or do something somebody doesn't like. And I will know this because someone will be sitting down the row from me in church giving me the side eye, and then someone will walk up to me after the service and say, "Nice going." Trust me, I've seen this movie before. In my house, where a prophet is often without honor, I am apparently famous as somebody who always talks about the same thing over and over again. So when I told my kids that I would be preaching again this morning, the response was simply, "Oh, community." Well, I could talk about other things, but as a matter of fact, that is our topic for today. There are many images and descriptions used for community, especially church community. People talk about the local church as being like a family, which has its pros and cons as an analogy, depending on everybody's experience of family. Others speak of a church community with language borrowed from the 12-step movement. And that certainly has merit. We are all broken and wounded. And at our best, this is a place where we can find and share healing. That has certainly been true for me. But one of the great images used throughout history is a nautical one, where we are all journeying together through difficult waters in search of a peaceful shore. I like this image. And I'm really grateful for the oar somebody put on the altar table. I think that's lovely. I've found a lot of meaning in this image over the years, and it offers so many great applications. For instance, at the beginning of this interim period, I had the privilege of meeting with some young adults in our church who were discouraged and wondering about the future of our community. Out of those conversations came a kind of slogan that we used, "All hands on deck." It articulated the idea that it would require every one of us to build a future, and that people who were just along for the ride were not what we needed most at that time. We needed everyone participating. We would pass each other in the hall and just repeat it to one another, "All hands on deck." And then just a few weeks ago, during our call weekend, I heard David Jordan say something a couple of times. When asked how we would know a year from now that this next chapter of our history was off to a good start, he talked about everyone rowing in the same direction. We all nodded our heads at that because we knew what he meant. I suspect we also nodded our heads because we know what it feels like when everyone is not rowing in the same direction. So if rowing in the same direction is a good idea for a church community, how do we go about doing that? I mean, some of us have been in churches for a lot of years, and I suspect that just maybe rowing in the same direction is something that doesn't happen all the time. How do we do this thing that we already know doesn't just happen by itself? As a matter of fact, we have some guidance on this matter. Paul, possibly the first church leadership coach, gave the church in Rome some advice that we can hear this morning. We just heard a passage from Romans 12 that can offer us some clues to becoming a community that rows in the same direction. That passage starts with a sting. "Do not think of yourself more highly than you ought to think." Paul is not pulling any punches here. With a quick show of hands, I wonder if anybody here would call that your favorite Bible verse. But that's half the battle right there. Another way of putting this is that we are not to place ourselves above an honest judgment of who we are or above others in the community. Think with sober judgment, Paul says, and we would do well to start with that. Then Paul goes into the part of this chapter that we probably know the best. "For as in one body, we have many members, and not all the members have the same function." We know this passage and the list that follows about gifts such as prophecy, teaching, leadership, and compassion. In 1 Corinthians, Paul goes even further, talking about the different parts of the body. He talks about the foot saying, "Because I am not a hand, I do not belong to the body," or the ear saying, "Because I am not an eye, I do not belong to the body." And Paul calls this foolish, referencing the need for every part of the body to do its work. Paul says that the eye cannot say to the hand, "I have no need of you," nor the head to the feet, "I have no need of you." When I was in youth group in high school, I remember a number of long and not always very kind conversations about which body part everybody really was. But this really isn't the point of the passage. The point is that we need each other. And the fact that we each bring something different to the table is not an accident. It's where the value and the purpose of being together is found. As software engineers and product designers say, it's a feature, not a bug. Now we get to the heart of what I believe the heart of Romans 12 is. Let's hear a little bit of it again from verse 9. It's a set of instructions. "Let love be genuine. Love one another with mutual affection. Outdo one another in showing honor. Rejoice in hope. Be patient in suffering. Persevere in prayer." contribute to the needs of the saints, extend hospitality to strangers. Bless those who persecute you. Bless and do not curse them. Rejoice with those who rejoice. Weep with those who weep. Live in harmony with one another. Do not be haughty. Do not claim to be wiser than you are. Do not repay anyone evil for evil, but take thought for what is noble. And if it is possible, so far as it depends on you, live peaceably with all. Well, there's a little something in that list to make each of us uncomfortable, isn't there? Like being different members of the same body, we find ourselves in this list. Some of us struggle with blessing those who curse us. Others of us struggle with not claiming to be wiser than we are. And some of us aren't all that patient in suffering. But these are the rules, guidelines for being in community with one another. In fact, these are the instructions that make it possible to live with those who are different from us, but part of the same body. That last verse, if it is possible, so far as it depends on you, live peaceably with all. That's been one of my favorites for decades, even though I often fail to live up to it. I really like the way it's phrased and the clause in the middle, so far as it depends on you. This means that Paul acknowledges that there are circumstances beyond your control, such as what the other person might say in the heat of a disagreement. But you are called to do your part. Do the part that you can do something about. Otherwise, the rest are just words. A couple of weeks ago, our guest preacher was David Sapp, who's the retired pastor at Second Ponce, and he talked about love, not as a feeling, but as an action. He spoke of his feelings of affection for his firstborn in the hospital, but said that it was several days later, at home, in the middle of the night with a crying baby, that he understood he was required to do love and not just feel it. This is what Paul is talking about. Everyone in the boat has to do their part, to pick up an oar and to row if we're going to get anywhere. Effort is required to do love, to be in community, to, in the words of Romans, love one another with mutual affection and outdo one another in showing honor. It takes work, not just words, to, as Paul says, be patient in suffering, persevere in prayer, contribute to the needs of the saints, and extend hospitality to strangers. When I was in another church many, many years ago, I heard someone use the Webster's definition of community, referencing something along the lines of a group of people united by a common set of interests. This discouraged me, and I felt like it really didn't cut it as a definition. It's too easy. It's easy to hang around with people who agree with you about everything, isn't it? Sometimes in a church, though, people come from different backgrounds, different neighborhoods, have very different educations, careers, and lifestyles. And in a place like that, we are called to be together when, in fact, we really have very little in common except for this one very important thing, the faith that unites us. I read something from CBF recently that referenced the desire to, quote, seek intentional community in spite of differences with a strong commitment to Scripture. And I really liked that. I would propose that this is what we're called to do and what the world needs to see us do. Because being of one spirit is easy when everyone agrees. But churches and communities, like families and democracies, are messy, and everyone doesn't always get their way. Sometimes you go to Yellowstone when you wanted to go to Disney World. And sometimes the person you didn't vote for gets elected. Come on, it's happened to all of us at least once. But we don't give up on each other just because someone else's project or policy or ministry won the day and ours did not. We don't give up on each other because this thing we're doing, this community we are part of, is worth the effort. It has never been more important than it is today for a church community to do this well, to remain together in spite of our differences. The word witness doesn't get used a lot in a 21st century moderate church, but I'd like to try to reclaim that word if I can. The world is partisan, divided, and let's face it, we don't even argue very well. And the church can be a powerful witness to God's redemptive love by showing the world in which we live and move a different way. It may even be one of the things that most sets us apart from any other group of like-minded people who pull together for a common purpose. We don't walk away from each other just because it's hard. If we back up to the beginning of Romans 12, there are a couple of famous verses that were not included in this morning's reading. I left them out because they are pretty well known and because I really wanted to start with the part about not thinking too much of ourselves. But let's hear them now, Romans 12, verses 1 and 2. I appeal to you, therefore, brothers and sisters, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies as a living sacrifice, holy and acceptable to God, which is your spiritual worship. Do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your minds, so that you may discern what is the will of God, what is good and acceptable and perfect. What does that mean, do not be conformed to this world? I think it means we're not supposed to be like everybody else. It's not a secret that everyone in this church community or any other does not always agree about everything, but I had a vision recently that I want to share with you. Many of you were present in Carriker Hall on the Saturday of the call weekend and listened to our new pastor answer some pretty difficult questions. Some of us liked his answers more than others, I imagine, but there was a spirit in the room. Did you feel it? There was a willingness to hear other viewpoints, an openness to ideas we might not share because, and I think this is the part that mattered, they were presented honestly and with humility. In the midst of that moment, a thought hit me with force, and after the conclusion, I had to find somebody and talk about it, that this is what it means to present a different witness to the world. What if this were a place where people treated each other with love and dignity, where we worked through disagreements in a spirit of humility and discovery, led by the Christ that unites us in one spirit? Wouldn't that be something for the world to see in 2018? Dietrich Bonhoeffer wrote that the incarnation of Christ happens in community, that the church is in fact, and I quote, Christ existing as community. Friends, I believe this to my core, and I hope some of you do too. Among other things, I think this means that our faith is made stronger in community, something that is sometimes forgotten in our consumer-driven, individualistic culture. We understand God better by being with one another. This is because when I encounter another person, I encounter Christ. That changes, or should change, how I interact with them, and it can change who I am. It's another way that we are transformed by the renewing of our minds. People don't want to just hear about faith. They want to see what it looks like in the communities of people who claim that faith and are claimed by it. One of the reasons I think people don't walk through church doors as much as they used to is that they don't see anything different here than they find anywhere else. And if that's true, then a church is just another club. But when people are transformed by the renewing of their minds, as Paul says, the God who led us in the past and continues to lead us today will renew and transform us as individuals and as a community. And that will show on our faces and in our words and in our deeds and in our lives. God's mission will be at the center of our life together. Not what I want or what you want, but what God is leading us to do in Decatur and Atlanta and around the world. But we have to do our part. We have to do the part that we can do something about. We have to do the work. We have to pick up an oar, and we have to row. Before I close, I want to say a little more about what I learned through the search process. I said before that the church has a good reputation in the wider world, but I learned more than that. I learned that good, thoughtful people are all over this place, and I had the privilege of serving with many of them. I learned that we are in good hands when thoughtful people like Kathy Kinlaw and Ronnie Jowers are sitting at the table. And I learned that when people like Eddie Campbell and Carla Stanford are praying for you, God listens. I learned that Tiffany Hahn, I hope I didn't get in trouble in the early service for calling a friend of mine a witch, but Tiffany Hahn, I'm tempted to use the line J.K. Rowling wrote about Hermione Granger, is the brightest witch of her age. And with leaders like that in our midst, the future of our church is in good hands. And I learned that Bob Woodson is a national treasure. Seriously, if we had a hall of heroes, or we put statues up somewhere on the property, there would be a place for Bob there. His love for this church, past, present, and future, guided our committee's work, and I, for one, am deeply grateful to have spent time with him over the past year. I learned that this body, this community, is worth the effort. That it's neither the healthiest nor the least healthy church in the world, but simply a group of believers united by a love for this town, this place, and our God. Yes, this body, known as First Baptist Decatur, has a history of which it can be proud, but we have to be careful. Sometimes I think that nostalgia should have its own 12-step group. And it's a challenge to be proud of a history and yet not bound by it. For that to be true, though, we have to believe that our best days lie ahead and that God will continue to lead us if we listen and follow, as God always has in the past. The world needs to see us embody the values of Jesus here, and I think we can do that. We just need everybody to pick up an oar and row, because there's work to do.